This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents, You Can Be a Stock Market Genius. Uncover the secret hiding places of stock market profits by Joel Greenblatt. Read by Jonathan Todd Ross.
Chapter 1. Follow the Yellow Brick Road. Then hang a right. It doesn't make sense that a book can teach you how to make a fortune in the stock market. After all, what chance do you have for success when you're up against an army of billion-dollar portfolio managers or a horde of freshly trained MBAs? A contest between you, the proud owner of a $24 how-to book, and these guys hardly seems fair. The truth is, it isn't fair. The well-heeled Wall Street money managers and the hotshot MBAs don't have a chance against you and this book. No, you won't find any magic formula in Chapter 8, and this isn't a sequel to How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. But if you're willing to invest a reasonable amount of time and effort, stock market profits and even a fortune await. Okay, what's the catch? If it's so easy, why can't the MBAs and the pros beat your pants off? Clearly, they put in their share of time and effort, and while they may not all be rocket scientists, there aren't many village idiots among them either. As strange as it may seem, there is no catch. The answer to this apparent paradox, why you potentially have the power to beat the pants off the so-called market experts, lies in a study of academic thinking, the inner workings of Wall Street, and the weekend habits of my in-laws. We start with some good news about your education. Simply put, if your goal is to beat the market, an MBA or a PhD from a top business school will be of virtually no help. Well, it's good news, that is, if you haven't yet squandered tons of time and money at a business school in the single-minded quest for stock market success. In fact, the basic premise of most academic theory is this. It is not possible to beat the market consistently other than by luck. This theory, usually referred to as the efficient market or random walk theory, suggests that thousands of investors and analysts take in all the publicly available information on a particular company, and through their decisions to buy and sell that company's stock, establish the correct trading price. In effect, since stocks are more or less efficiently priced, and therefore you can't consistently find bargain-priced stocks, it is not possible to outperform the market averages over long periods of time. Although exceptions, e.g. the January effect, small size effects, and low price slash earnings strategies, are covered briefly by the academics, most of these market-beating strategies are dismissed as trivial, transient, or difficult to achieve after factoring in taxes and transaction costs. Since beating the market is out of the question, finance professors spend a lot of time teaching things like quadratic parametric programming, which loosely translates to how to pick diversified stock portfolios in three-dimensional space. In other words, if you muddle through complex mathematical formulas and throw in a little calculus and statistical theory along the way, you stand a pretty good chance of matching the performance of the popular market averages. Wow! While there are plenty of other bells and whistles, the message is clear. You can't beat the market, so don't even try. Thousands of MBAs and PhDs have paid good money for this lousy advice. There are two reasons not to accept the basic teachings of the professors. First, there are some fundamental flaws in the assumptions and methodology used by the academics, flaws we'll look at briefly later on, but which are not the central focus of this book. Second, and more important, even if the professors are generally correct and the market for stocks is more or less efficient, their studies and conclusions do not apply to you. Obviously, most of Wall Street must also ignore the academics because the whole concept of getting paid for your investment advice, whether through commissions or investment advisory fees, doesn't square too well with the idea that the advice really isn't worth anything. Unfortunately for the professionals, the facts would seem to support the conclusions of the academics. If academic theory held true, you would expect the long-term record of pension and mutual fund managers to equal the performance of the market averages reduced by the amount of the advisory fee. In a slight deviation from efficient market theory, the professionals actually do approximately 1% worse per year than the relevant market averages, even before deducting their management fees. Does the theory that markets are more or less efficient explain this disappointing performance on the part of professionals? Or are there other factors at work that lead to these lackluster results? The Professional's Challenge. I spoke with a professional whom I consider one of the best in the business, a friend I'll call Bob, even though his real name is Rich. Bob is in charge of $12 billion of U.S. equity funds at a major investment firm. For some perspective, if you went to the racetrack and placed a bet with $100 bills, $12 billion would stack 20 World Trade Centers high. Needless to say, a bet that would almost certainly kill the odds on your horse. According to Bob, the bottom line and the measure of his success is this. How does the return on his portfolio stack up against the return of the Standard & Poor's 500 average? In fact, Bob's record is phenomenal. Over the past 10 years, his average annual return has exceeded the return of the S&P 500 by between 2 and 3%. At first blush, the word phenomenal and an increased annual yield of 2 or 3% seem somewhat incongruous. Though it is true that after 20 years of compounding, even 2% extra per year creates a 50% larger nest egg, this is not why Bob's returns are phenomenal. Bob's performance is impressive because in the world of billion-dollar portfolios, this level of excess return is incredibly hard to come by on a consistent basis. Some quick calculations help expose the limitations imposed on Bob by the sheer size of his portfolio. Imagine the dollar investment in each stock position when Bob sets out to divvy up $12 billion. To create a 50-stock portfolio, the average investment in each individual stock would have to be approximately $240 million. For 100 stocks, $120 million. There are approximately 9,000 stocks listed on the New York Stock Exchange, the American Stock Exchange, and the NASDAQ over-the-counter market combined. Of this number, about 800 stocks have a market capitalization over $2.5 billion, and approximately 1,500 have market values over $1 billion. If we assume Bob does not care to own more than 10% of any company's outstanding shares, for legal and liquidity reasons, it's likely that the minimum number of different stocks Bob will end up with in his portfolio will fall somewhere between 50 and 100. If he chooses to expand the universe from which he chooses potential purchase candidates to those companies with market capitalizations below $1 billion, perhaps to take advantage of some lesser followed and possibly undiscovered bargain stocks, his minimum number could easily expand to over 200 different stocks. Intuitively, you would probably agree that there is an advantage to holding a diversified portfolio so that one or two unfortunate, read, bonehead, stock picks do not unduly impair your confidence and pocketbook. On the other hand, is the correct number of different stocks to own in a properly diversified portfolio 50, 100, or even 200? It turns out that diversification addresses only a portion, and not the major portion, of the overall risk of investing in the stock market. Even if you took the precaution of owning 9,000 stocks, you would still be at risk for the up and down movement of the entire market. This risk, known as market risk, would not have been eliminated by your perfect diversification. While simply buying more stocks can't help you avoid market risk, it can help you avoid another kind of risk, non-market risk. Non-market risk is the portion of a stock's risk that is not related to the stock market's overall movements. This type of risk can arise when a company's factory burns down or when a new product doesn't sell as well as expected. By not placing all your eggs in a buggy whip, breast implant, pet rock, or huck-a-poo sweater company, You can diversify away that portion of your risk that comes from the misfortunes of any individual company. Statistics say that owning just two stocks eliminates 46% of the non-market risk of owning just one stock. This type of risk is supposedly reduced by 72% with a four-stock portfolio, by 81% with eight stocks, 93% with 16 stocks, 96% with 32 stocks, and 99% with 500 stocks. Without quibbling over the accuracy of these particular statistics, two things should be remembered. 1. After purchasing 6 or 8 stocks in different industries, the benefit of adding even more stocks to your portfolio in an effort to decrease risk is small. And 2. Overall market risk will not be eliminated merely by adding more stocks to your portfolio. From a practical standpoint, when Bob chooses his favorite stocks and is on pick number 20, 30, or 80, he is pursuing a strategy imposed on him by the dollar size of his portfolio, legal issues, and fiduciary considerations, not because he feels his last picks are as good as his first, or because he needs to own all those stocks for optimum portfolio diversification. In short, poor Bob has to come up with scores of great stock ideas, choose from a limited universe of the most widely followed stocks, buy and sell large amounts of individual stocks without affecting their share prices, and perform in a fishbowl where his returns are judged quarterly and even monthly. Luckily, you don't. The secret to your fortune. Since Bob clearly has his hands full, where can an investor turn for insight into making a fortune in the stock market? For better or worse, all roads appear to leave us at the doorstep of my in-laws. Don't worry, I said mine, not yours. A typical weekend will find them scouting out a country auction, antique store, or estate sale looking for art or antiques that catch their fancy. As avid collectors, they seek out works that will give them joy to own and live with on a daily basis. As closet capitalists, they look for undiscovered or unrecognized works of art or antiques that they can buy at prices far below true value. When in capitalist mode, the in-laws follow a very simple strategy. Whether they find a beautiful specimen of antique furniture at Podunk Fine Antiques and Tractor Parts, or an impressionist painting from Grandma Bag of Donuts' attic, they ask themselves only one question before buying. Are there comparable pieces of furniture or paintings that have recently sold at auction or to dealers at prices far above the potential purchase price? It's truly that simple, although we can probably learn more from the questions they don't ask. They don't ask, is this painter going to be the next Picasso? Or, is 18th century French furniture going to skyrocket in value? While it would be nice and perhaps more lucrative to be able to predict those types of future developments, few people can combine the ability, knowledge, and timing to foresee and profit consistently from future events. Whether the in-laws can or cannot predict the future is beside the point. They don't have to. They already know how to profit from studying the present. That doesn't mean their knowledge of art and antiques doesn't help them to make money, but many people can acquire that same knowledge. Their edge comes from taking this knowledge and applying it in places off the beaten path. While these places are tougher to find, once found, less competition from other informed collectors creates an opportunity for them to find inefficiently priced bargains. Finding bargain stocks works much the same way. If you spend your energies looking for and analyzing situations not closely followed by other informed investors, your chance of finding bargains greatly increases. The trick is locating those opportunities. It's like the old story about the plumber who comes to your house, bangs on the pipes once, and says, "That'll be $100." "$100?" you say. "All you did was bang on the pipes once." "Oh, no," the plumber responds. "Banging on the pipes is only $5. Knowing where to bang? That's $95. In the stock market, knowing where to bang is the secret to your fortune. With that in mind, let's uncover some of the secret hiding places of stock market profits. Chapter 2. Some Basics. Don't leave home without them. When I was 15, the only gambling establishment that would let me sneak in was the Hollywood Dog Track. This was a great thing because during my first illicit visit, I discovered a surefire route to big greyhound riches. In the third race, there was a dog who had run each of his previous six races in only 32 seconds. The odds on this dog, we'll call him Lucky, were 99 to 1. None of the dogs up against Lucky in the third race had managed a time better than 44 seconds in any previous race. Of course, I bet what passed for a small fortune at the time on Lucky to win. If all those fools who bet on the other dogs wanted to give me their money, so be it. However, as Lucky straggled down the home stretch in last place, my opinion of the other gamblers slowly began to change. This was Lucky's first race at a longer distance. Apparently, as everyone else already knew, Lucky's spectacularly fast times in his previous races were achieved at much shorter distances. All the other dogs were experienced long-distance runners. My 99-to-1 sure thing was a mirage that quickly evaporated along with my money. On the bright side, in less than a minute, I learned a valuable lesson. Without a basic level of knowledge and understanding, you can't tell a great investment from a real dog. So before you start hunting in the stock market's back alleys for hidden investment jewels, here are some basics that should help in the search. A few basics. 1. Do your own work. There are really two reasons to do your own work. The first is pretty simple. You have no choice. If you are truly looking at situations that others are ignoring, there will rarely be much media or Wall Street coverage. While there is usually plenty of industry or company information available, some of it quite helpful, almost none will focus on the special attributes that make your investment opportunity attractive. This should be fine with you. The more the merrier is not your credo. The other reason to do your own work is closely related. As much as possible, you don't want to be well paid merely for taking big risks. Anyone can manage that. You want to be well paid because you did your homework. If you are one of the few people to analyze a particular investment opportunity, it follows that you are in the best position to assess the appropriate payoff for the risk taken. Not all obscure or hidden investment opportunities are attractive. The idea is to place your bets in situations where the rewards promise to greatly outweigh the risks. Naturally, everyone would like to invest in situations where the odds are stacked in their favor. But most people can't because they don't know these special opportunities exist. The payoff to all your legwork and analysis is the opportunity to invest in situations that offer unfair economic returns. Your extraordinary profits will not be a result of taking on big risks. They will be the justly deserved pay for doing your homework. But is it any fun to invest when the odds are unfairly stacked in your favor? You bet it is. 2. Don't trust anyone over 30. 3. Don't trust anyone 30 or under. Get it? The odds of anyone calling you on the phone with good investment advice are about the same as winning lotto without buying a ticket. It could happen, but it's not bloody likely. When stockbrokers call or write, take Nancy Reagan's advice, just say no. The record of research analysts and major brokerage firms for predicting future earnings or stock prices is quite poor. And if you believe the record of smaller brokerage firms who tout penny stocks is any better, please write me for a refund. You can't be helped. Even institutional clients of reputable investment firms don't get particularly good advice. The reasons for this consistently poor showing are largely systematic in nature. The vast majority of analysts are not directly paid by clients. The research recommendations and reports produced by these analysts are peddled by the firm's stockbrokers in exchange for commission business. One perennial problem is the overwhelming incentive for analysts to issue buy recommendations. The universe of stocks not owned by a customer is always much larger than the list of those currently owned. Consequently, it's much easier to generate commissions from new buy recommendations than from recommendations to sell. Another occupational hazard for research analysts is that analysts who pan a company's stock are usually cut off from an important source of information. Crucial contact with company officers and information from investor relations personnel may well be reserved for other, more cooperative analysts. This obviously makes the job more difficult. In addition, the chance of the offending analyst's investment firm capturing future investment banking assignments from that company is probably slim. This is why popular euphemisms like source of funds, hold, and untimely are used instead of the more direct sell recommendation. There are several other problems besides this optimistic bias. It is very difficult to go out on a limb with earnings or stock price predictions if all your fellow analysts think differently. It's much safer to be wrong in a crowd than to risk being the only one to misread a situation that everyone else pegged correctly. As a result, getting fresh, independent thinking from analysts is the exception, not the norm. Further, most analysts cover only one industry group. You have chemical analysts, bank analysts, and retail analysts who know little about the comparative investment merits of stocks in other industries. So when a chemical analyst says buy a stock in his industry, he has not compared its investment prospects against stocks in any of 50 other industry groups. A neighborhood in downtown Cleveland may look great next to one three blocks over, but not when compared to Beverly Hills. Since an analyst's job is to compare companies within particular industry groups, extraordinary corporate events often fall outside an analyst's specific area of expertise. This is true even when these special events, like spin-offs or mergers, involve companies he does follow. Many analysts actually suspend ratings or drop coverage of companies that are undergoing major corporate changes, understandable given their job description, but not too helpful if their real goal is to give profitable investment advice. The next thing analysts run up against is cold hard economics. It doesn't pay for Wall Street analysts to cover stocks or investment situations unless they can generate enough revenue, read commissions or future investment banking fees, to make the time and effort involved worthwhile. Therefore, smaller capitalization stocks whose shares don't trade in large volumes, obscure securities, and unique situations are generally ignored. Ironically, the very areas that are uneconomic for large firms to explore are precisely the ones that hold the most potential profit for you. The bottom line is, even if you live in fantasy land, where fees and commissions have no influence on investment advice, you still must face a harsh reality. Your broker, trustworthy or not, has no idea how to invest your money. But don't blame him, even if he is over 30. It's the system, man. It just doesn't work. Still want a hot tip from someone you can trust? Okay. Psst. Bet lucky in the third at Hollywood. 4. Pick your spots. The highlight of summer camp was Color War. For the uninitiated, Color War was a week-long ritual each summer in which the entire camp was divided into two teams, the blue and the gray. The teams then competed, by age group, for the most victories in a variety of sports. The highlight of Color War was something called the Apache Relay. This was a single race at the end of Color War, pitting one team encompassing all age groups against the other. Every camper, domino style, had an individual athletic challenge or bizarre task to complete before the next camper on his team could attempt his own feat. So like the Apache warriors of old, one by one, campers would compete in events from simple running and swimming to pie eating, with hands tied behind the back, and walking with an egg balanced on a spoon stuck between the teeth. The advantage of one team over the other, unlike some other competitions, did not necessarily hinge on which team had the stronger or faster athletes, but rather on which team had been lucky enough to get David Versotsky. David had the task of serving 3 net serves in ping pong before the next camper on his team could perform a more mundane task, like running down to the waterfront. In ping pong, a net serve is when the ball is served, hits the net, and still manages to land on the other side of the table. All summer long, David was just a regular guy, but he could whip these serves off on demand. 1, 2, 3, like nobody else, saving crucial minutes in an Apache relay that was often decided in a matter of seconds. In those tense moments before the race, the buzz around David's team was always something like, "Don't worry, we have Versatsky." I don't know whatever happened to David, but unquestionably, if net serves in ping pong had been a professional or even Olympic sport, the name David Versatsky would today be mentioned in the same company with Babe Ruth or Michael Jordan. What's the point? The point is that if David could arrange it so that any time he competed, it would be a contest of who could hit the most net serves, he would do a lot of winning. Unfortunately, life doesn't usually work that way. You can't always choose your battles or your playing field. When it comes to the stock market, though, you can. This concept has been variously illustrated by the likes of Warren Buffett as swing at only one of 20 pitches, there are no called strikes on Wall Street, or wait for your pitch. The most successful horse players, I guess they lose the least, are the ones who don't bet on every race, but wager on only those occasions when they have a clear conviction. It makes sense that if you limit your investments to those situations where you are knowledgeable and confident, and only those situations, your success rate will be very high. There is no sense diluting your best ideas or favorite situations by continuing to work your way down a list of attractive opportunities. If net serves was only one of the 10 events in a newly created decathlon, David's advantage and expertise would be diluted to such an extent that his chances of winning the entire decathlon would be slim. So if no one stops you from just hitting net serves, keep doing it until they cart you away. The strategy of putting all your eggs in one basket and watching that basket is less risky than you might think. If you assume, based on past history, that the average annual return from investing in the stock market is approximately 10%, statistics say the chance of any year's return falling between minus 8% and plus 28% are about 2 out of 3. In statistical talk, the standard deviation around the market average of 10% in any one year is approximately 18%. Obviously, there is still a 1 out of 3 chance of falling outside this incredibly wide 36-point range, minus 8% to plus 28%. These statistics hold for portfolios containing 50 or 500 different securities. In other words, the type of portfolios held by most stock mutual funds. What do statistics say you can expect, though, if your portfolio is limited to only 5 securities? The range of expected returns in any one year really must be immense. Who knows how the crazy movements of one or two stocks can skew results? The answer is that there is an approximately 2 out of 3 chance that your return will fall in a range of minus 11%, to plus 31%. The expected return of the portfolio still remains 10%. If there are 8 stocks in your portfolio, the range narrows a little further, to minus 10% to plus 30%. Not a significant difference from owning 500 stocks. The fact that you can drive a truck through any of these wide ranges of expected returns should lend comfort to those who don't hold 50 stocks in their portfolio and strike fear in the hearts of anyone who thinks owning dozens of stocks will assure them a predictable annual income. Over the long term, and this could mean 20 or 30 years long, stocks, despite the annual variability in returns, are probably the most attractive investment vehicle. Therefore, owning a widely diversified portfolio of stocks should enable you more or less to mirror the performance of the popular market averages. In the case of stocks, doing average ain't all that bad. However, if your goal is to do significantly better than average, then picking your spots, swinging at one of 20 pitches, sticking to net serves or any other metaphor that brings the point home for you, is the way to go. The fact that this highly selective process may leave you with only a handful of positions that fit your strict criteria shouldn't be a problem. The penalty you pay for having a focused portfolio, a slight increase in potential annual volatility, should be far outweighed by your increased long-term returns. Still not comfortable with the concept of putting a small group of eggs all in one basket? Don't despair. There are other ways to tackle the issue of risk without diluting the effectiveness of investing only in your few favorite situations. 5. Don't buy more stocks. Put money in the bank. For about $1,000, an insurance company will agree to pay a healthy 35-year-old male $1 million should he be unfortunate enough to die over the next year. The actuarial tables say this is a good bet for the insurance company. But would you take the insurance company's side of the bet? Probably not. The reason is that regardless of what the statistics may indicate, you can't afford to lose $1 million, especially for a crummy $1,000. The insurance company, on the other hand, by pooling thousands of policyholders together, can create a portfolio of underwritten risks that do follow the statistical tables. That's why they can make a good business out of consistently booking bets that you as an individual can't afford to take. In effect, a specific risk, when viewed in isolation, may appear unsafe or even foolish, but in the context of an entire portfolio, the same risk can make good sense. So if that's true, and spreading your risks around is such a good idea, why do I keep telling you that owning just a few stocks is the way to go? The answer comes in two parts. First, on each individual policy, the insurance company was risking a loss of $1,000 for every $1 bet. It would take many thousands of similar policies over a period of years to make this bet worthwhile. Fortunately, the risks you assume by purchasing individual stocks are limited to a $1 loss for each $1 invested. As a result, you can prudently invest in only a handful of attractive stocks without being accused of taking crazy risks. But everyone else advises maintaining a widely diversified portfolio. How can you be expected to go for it by focusing on only a few selected stock market opportunities? The answer, and the other reason why a widely diversified stock portfolio isn't a magic formula for avoiding risk, can be found in the way you should be thinking about your stock investments from the start. It's important to remember that for many people, a stock portfolio is only a portion of their entire investment holdings. Most people have a portion of their net worth in the bank or in money market funds, in their homes, in bonds, in the value of their life insurance policies, or in investment real estate, to name a few likely places. If you're looking to avoid putting all your eggs in one basket, this broader type of diversification, over varying asset classes, will accomplish that goal more effectively than merely diversifying your stock portfolio. In other words, don't screw up a perfectly good stock market strategy by diversifying your way into mediocre returns. In fact, no matter how many different stocks you buy, investing in the stock market with money that you will need over the next 2 or 3 years to help with rent or mortgage payments, food, medical care, tuition, or other necessities is risky in the first place. Remember, the potential swings in stock market returns from year to year are huge anyway, even if you diversify to the extent of owning all 9,000 plus stocks. Rest assured, the practice of selling stocks when you need the money holds little promise as an effective investment method. Ideally, your decisions to buy and sell stocks should be based solely on the investment merits. This may mean leaving that extra money in the bank or in other assets, even if you've made up your mind that stocks are the investment vehicle of choice. Leaving some of your assets on the sidelines, i.e. out of the stock market, should be your compromise to prudent diversification. As long as you're willing to do your own homework, a strategy of owning a select handful of your favorite stock situations should yield results far superior to a strategy of owning dozens of different stocks or mutual funds. From time to time, this selective strategy may result in slightly wider swings in performance than a strategy based on owning a few shares of everything, or what's known as an indexing approach. However, if you have arranged your overall portfolio of assets so that you can weather the inevitable market downswings without being forced to sell, this slight difference shouldn't matter. What should matter is that over a period of even 5 or 10 years, you can have your cake and eat it too. During those years, you will have invested in dozens of different investment situations, although in only a handful at any one time, thereby getting plenty of diversification with superior returns to boot. 6. Look down, not up. One cherished and immutable law of investing is that there is a trade-off between risk and reward. The more risk you assume in your portfolio, academics and most professionals agree, the more reward you receive in the form of higher returns. The less risk assumed, the lower the return. In short, you can't get something, high returns, for nothing, taking low risks. This concept is so fundamental that it provides the underpinning for the investment strategies of both academics and professionals. Of course, if the discussion ended there, you could just dial up your desired level of risk and receive the targeted return you deserve. In a perfectly efficient world, this relationship between risk and reward should hold true. Obviously, since you will be looking for pockets of opportunity where there are inefficiently priced investments, i.e. stocks or investment situations so far off the beaten path that analysts and investors have not priced them correctly, this immutable relationship between risk and reward should not apply. That, however, does not make the concept of risk-reward irrelevant to you. Far from it. It is, perhaps, the most important investment concept of all. That's why it's so amazing that, at least when it comes to analyzing the risks of individual stocks, most professionals and academics get it wrong. They get it wrong because they measure the risk portion of risk-reward in an erroneous and truly puzzling way. Risk, according to generally accepted wisdom, is defined as the risk of receiving volatile returns. In the academic world, risk is measured by a stock's beta, the price volatility of a particular stock relative to the market as a whole. Usually, the calculation of beta is based on an extrapolation of a stock's past price volatility. In this topsy-turvy world, the distinction between upside volatility and downside volatility is greatly confused. A stock that moves up significantly over the course of a year is labeled riskier than a stock that moves down slightly during the same period. Also, using past price movements or volatility as the basis for determining the riskiness of a particular stock can often lead to faulty conclusions. A stock that has fallen from 30 to 10 is considered riskier than a stock that has fallen from 12 to 10 in the same period. Although both stocks can now be purchased for $10, the stock which has fallen the farthest, and the one that is now priced at the biggest discount to its recent high price, is still considered the riskier of the two. It might be, but it could be that most of the stock's downside risk has been eliminated by the huge price drop. The truth is, you can't really tell much of anything just from measuring a stock's past price movements. In fact, not only doesn't a stock's past price volatility serve as a good indicator of future profitability, it doesn't tell you something much more important: how much you can lose. Let's repeat that. It doesn't tell you how much you can lose. Isn't risk of loss what most people care about when they think of risk? Comparing the risk of loss in an investment to the potential gain is what investing is all about. Perhaps, since the measurement of potential gain and loss from a particular stock is so subjective, it is easier, if you are a professional or academic, to use a concept like volatility as a substitute or a replacement for risk than to use some other measure. Whatever the reason for everyone else's general abdication of common sense, your job remains to quantify by some measure a stock's upside and downside. This is such an imprecise and difficult task, though, that a proxy of your own may well be in order. One way to take on this challenge is to think once again in terms of the in-laws. As you recall, if they find a painting selling for $5,000, when a comparable painting by the same artist has recently sold at auction for $10,000, they buy it. The perceived cushion of $5,000 between auction value and purchase price is what Benjamin Graham, the acknowledged father of security analysis, referred to as their margin of safety. If the in-laws' perceptions are correct, their margin is so large that it is extremely unlikely they will lose money on their new purchase. On the other hand, if their perceptions are somewhat off, the quality of their painting is not quite up to the standard of the one recently auctioned, the $10,000 price was a one-time aberration or the art market collapses between the time of purchase and the time they get to the auction house, their losses should be minimized by this initial built-in cushion, their margin of safety. So one way to create an attractive risk-reward situation is to limit downside risk severely by investing in situations that have a large margin of safety. The upside, while still difficult to quantify, will usually take care of itself. In other words, look down, not up, when making your initial investment decision. If you don't lose money, most of the remaining alternatives are good ones. While this basic concept is simple enough, it would be very difficult to devise a complicated mathematical formula to illustrate the point. Then again, not much downside to that. 7. There's more than one road to investment heaven. There are plenty of ways to achieve substantial wealth through investing in the stock market. Likewise, there are plenty of people who try. There are, however, only a select few who succeed. As Butch and Sundance might say, who are those guys and how do they do it? One such successful investor, whose methods should be studied closely, has just been mentioned. Benjamin Graham has influenced many investors through his writings and teaching. The concept of margin of safety is perhaps his greatest and most enduring contribution to the investing profession. Graham generally used objective measures like a stock's book value, the company's net worth as disclosed on its balance sheet, and its price-earnings ratio, the price of a stock relative to its annual earnings, aka its P/E ratio, to help calculate a company's true value. His advice was to purchase stocks only when they traded at a significant discount to this value. When viewing the stock market, Graham said, you should imagine that you are in business with Mr. Market, and that the price of a stock merely represents the cost of a certain percentage ownership of an entire company. Some days Mr. Market will be inordinately happy and quote you a ridiculously high price for your stock, and other days he will be unduly fearful and quote an unreasonably low price. Only at these extremes should you take advantage of Mr. Market and care what he has to say. Otherwise, it's best, according to Graham, to forget about the market and concentrate on a company's operating and financial fundamentals. It seems more than a coincidence that, of the small group of investors who have been extraordinarily successful over long periods of time, most adhere in some form to Graham's concepts of margin of safety and Mr. Market. Even in the area of company valuation, where some have successfully altered or expanded upon Graham's methods, Graham's original concepts have been repeatedly validated. Recent studies, e.g., Lakanishak, Schlieffer, and Vishny, Journal of Finance, December 1994, continue to support his thesis that simply buying stocks that trade at low prices relative to their book values and earnings provides superior long-term results. According to these studies, a value approach to stock picking, such as Graham's, far surpasses the results achieved by buying the so-called glamour, or most popular stocks, purchasing stock market index funds, or placing money with professional managers. These results can be achieved, contrary to efficient market theory, without taking on more volatility than other methods, and they apply to both large and small capitalization stocks. The explanation for this may be that individuals and professionals systematically overrate the long-term prospects of companies that have done well recently, and at the same time underestimate the value of companies that are underperforming or unpopular at the moment. Relying on objective measures like a company's book value and historical earnings to determine value may help eliminate some of the emotional and institutional biases likely to be found in more future-based valuation methods. Even though Graham's methods have been well documented and extensively studied, they continue to yield superior results for those investors who choose to follow them. Graham's most famous disciple and admirer, Warren Buffett, while a strong proponent of seeking investments with a large margin of safety and of viewing the stock market from the vantage point of Mr. Market, has successfully added his own thoughts about what constitutes value when seeking attractive investments. Primarily, Buffett has found that investing in fundamentally good businesses As opposed to investing solely in stocks priced cheaply in a strict statistical sense, can add dramatically to investment returns. While this hardly seems an insight worthy of marching bands and fireworks, this seemingly minor modification is the most likely reason why Buffett has become not only Graham's most successful disciple, but by most counts the world's greatest investor. Buffett tries to focus on well-managed companies that have a strong franchise, brand name, or market niche. In addition, his investments are concentrated in businesses that he understands well, and that possess attractive underlying economic, that is, they generate lots of cash, and competitive characteristics. In this way, when Buffett buys a business at what appears to be an attractive discount to current value, he also benefits from the future increase in value generated by owning all or part of a business that is well situated. Graham's statistical bargains generally do not benefit from this added kicker. In fact, according to Buffett, the risk in buying poor businesses is that much of the bargain element of the initial purchase discount may well be dissipated by the time a catalyst comes along to unlock what appeared to be the initial excess value. Yet another successful approach to stock market investing has been championed by perhaps the world's greatest mutual fund manager, Peter Lynch. The Fidelity Magellan Fund, which he ran successfully through 1990, returned $28 for every dollar invested at the start of his tenure in 1977. Through his books, columns, and interviews, Lynch strongly suggests that ordinary individuals can outperform the experts by investing in companies and industries that they already know and understand. Whether you're at the mall, the supermarket, or even the amusement park, new investment prospects are everywhere, according to Lynch. He believes that with a reasonable amount of company research and investigation, the type well within reach of the average investor, everyday insights and experiences can be turned into a profitable stock portfolio. While not in the same league as a Peter Lynch, he managed $14 billion when he wrote his first book, they managed $90,000, the Beardstown ladies for a time appeared to have run up an enviable investment record. Their secret weapon? Value Line. The Value Line Investment Survey is a weekly publication with extensive fundamental and statistical data on approximately 1,700 of the largest public companies. Each week, Value Line ranks the stocks in this universe for timeliness and safety. In general, the stock's Value Line ranks highest for timeliness. Rankings of 1 or 2 on a scale of 5 have handily outperformed the market averages over a 30-year period. Value Line uses a proprietary formula that includes factors like a stock's earnings and price momentum, positive and negative earnings surprises, and certain fundamental attributes to determine its stock rankings. The investment opinions of Value Line's research analysts were once included in the ranking system, but this input was dropped long ago as the system performed better without them. This may also partially explain where the Beardstown ladies went wrong. Starting from a list of Value Line's top-ranked stocks, and using some of the other data provided, the ladies added some input of their own. Evidently, this input caused their portfolio to significantly underperform both Value Line's computerized ranking system and the market in general. The ladies also included a rather long list of recipes in their book. It is not known whether these had any effect on investment performance. Regardless, Value Line's record remains largely untarnished. While there are obviously other effective investment methods, a reasonable question at this point would be, how does the idea of ferreting out investment winners from the stock market's hidden nooks and crannies stack up against the methods just discussed? While certainly reasonable, this question may be a little misleading. Simply because you'll be looking for investments in out-of-the-way places doesn't mean that you can't or shouldn't apply some of the wisdom gleaned from studying the winning methods of a Graham, Buffett, or Lynch. Of course, once you've gone to the trouble of finding an interesting investment in a remote corner of the market, hopefully your analysis won't have to be any more subtle than figuring out whether an anvil fell on your head. Alas, although this is a worthy and not entirely unrealistic goal, life won't always be that easy. Applying some lessons from the masters, at the very least, should help when the investment decisions become a bit more taxing. At most, since picking your spots is one of the keys to your success, following the basic principles of these investment greats should keep you focused in the right places. The secret hiding places of stock market profits. All right, already. Where are these secret hiding places? Don't worry. You don't have to look under Love Canal or get shot down spying over some secret Russian military base. It's not that straightforward. The answer is, stock market profits can be hiding anywhere, and their hiding places are always changing. In fact, the underlying theme to most of these investment situations is change. Something out of the ordinary course of business is taking place that creates an investment opportunity. The list of corporate events that can result in big profits for you runs the gamut. Spin-offs, mergers, restructurings, rights offerings, bankruptcies, liquidations, asset sales, distributions. And it's not just the events themselves that can provide profits. Each such event can produce a whole host of new securities with their own extraordinary investment potential. The great thing is, there's always something happening. Dozens of corporate events each week, too many for any one person to follow. But that's the point. You can't follow all of them, and you don't have to. Even finding one good opportunity a month is far more than you should need or want. As you listen to this book, in example after example, in lesson after lesson, you may wonder, how the hell could I have found that one? Or, I never would have figured that out. Both are probably true. But there will be plenty of others that you do find and can figure out. Even after you learn where to look for new ideas, the notion that you can cover even one-tenth of these special corporate events is a pipe dream. On the other hand, making incredible profits over your lifetime from the ones you do work on isn't. The old cliche holds true. Teach a man to fish. What about all the other ways to get rich? There are no flaws in the investment methods of Warren Buffett or Peter Lynch. The problem is that you're not likely to be the next Buffett or Lynch. Investing in great businesses at good prices makes sense. Figuring out which are the great ones is the tough part. Monopoly newspapers and network broadcasters were once considered near-perfect businesses. Then new forms of competition and the last recession brought those businesses a little bit closer to earth. The world is a complicated and competitive place. It is only getting more so. The challenges you face in choosing the few stellar businesses that will stand out in the future will be even harder than the ones faced by Buffett when he was building his fortune. Are you up to the task? Do you have to be? Finding the next Walmart, McDonald's, or Gap is also a tough one. There are many more failures than successes. Using your own experiences and intuition to choose good investments is excellent advice. It should be applied in every investment you make. You should invest only in what you know and understand. It's just that Peter Lynch is an especially talented individual. It's likely that he knows and understands more than you when it comes down to making the tough calls. On the other hand, Ben Graham's statistical approach was actually designed with the individual investor in mind. A widely diversified portfolio of stocks with low PE ratios and low price-to-book ratios still produces excellent results and is relatively easy to emulate. Graham figured that if you owned 20 or 30 of these statistical bargains, you didn't need to do extensive research. You don't. Reading and studying Graham's work is how I first became fascinated with the stock market. I still apply his teachings wherever and whenever I can. It's just that if you are willing to do some of your own work, pick your spots, and look in places where others are not looking, you can do significantly better than Graham's more passive method. Recently, it became even easier to do your own research. Information that in Graham's day wasn't available at all, or if it was, had to be uncovered from obscure state and federal filings, is now readily available. Until recently, the same information, located among the prodigious amounts of public filings that companies are required to make with the SEC, was available but largely inaccessible. documents describing the type of extraordinary corporate changes and events that will be the source of your investment profits were usually provided by private corporations charging up to $200 or $300 for one document. Now, this same information is instantly available on, you guessed it, the Internet, for the price of a phone call. Of course, you still have to be willing to read it. Are there any drawbacks to investing in these special corporate situations? Two come immediately to mind. The first, you know. It will take some work. The good news is that you will be well paid. The other drawback may or may not apply to you. Although some of these extraordinary corporate events play out over a period of years, others transpire over a period of months. Your investment advantage is usually at its greatest immediately before, during, and right after the corporate event or change. Your window of opportunity may be short, and therefore your holding period may also be short. As there is a tax advantage for many people from receiving long-term capital gains from investments held more than 1 year, and an advantage for everyone in deferring their taxable gains by not selling appreciated securities, a short holding period in some of these situations creates a disadvantage compared to the long-term strategies of Buffett, Lynch, and Graham. Fortunately, you can avoid some of these disadvantages either by investing in only those situations that take several years to fully play out, or by investing through your pension, IRA, or other retirement accounts. Qualifying retirement accounts can generally be managed without concern for taxes. One more point. Although most people take comfort in crowds, this is not where successful investors generally look for good investment ideas. Nevertheless, you may take comfort in the fact that the practice of investing in companies undergoing corporate change is not an alien concept to Buffett, Lynch, or Graham. Each of these great investors has spent some time investing in this arena. It's just that Graham was most concerned about passing on his wisdom to the individual investor. He felt accumulating a diversified portfolio of statistical bargains would be a more accessible way for most people to invest. Buffett and Lynch both had the problem of investing huge sums of money, billions of dollars. It is often difficult to take large enough positions in these special investment situations to make an impact on that size portfolio. For your first quarter billion or so, though, it's no problem. Call me when you get there. So roll up your sleeves and put your thinking caps on. You're going on a wild ride into the stock market's twilight zone. You'll go places where others fear to tread, or at least don't know about. When you enter these largely uncharted waters and discover the secrets buried there, you will finally know what it feels like to be one of the glorious few who climb Mount Everest, plant a flag at the North Pole, or walk on the moon. Okay, so it'll probably feel more like finishing a crossword puzzle. I've never done that either, but I'm sure that feels great too. In any event, let's get going. Chapter 3. Chips off the old stock. Spin-offs, partial spin-offs, and rights offerings. I lost a bet. The stakes, dinner at Lutèce, loser treats. Being a bachelor at the time, my idea of living was to slap a slice of cheese on top of an uncut bagel. My own recipe, not one from the Beardstown ladies. So there I was, at perhaps the finest restaurant in the world, certainly in New York, looking over the menu. Over walks a gentleman in full chef's garb to help with our order. Somehow, his outfit didn't tip me off that this was actually André Saltner, proprietor and head chef. Pointing to one of the appetizers on the menu, I asked innocently, "Is this one any good?" "No, it stinks," came Saltner's reply. Even though he was just kidding around, I did get the point. Pretty much everything on the menu was going to be good. Selecting Lutèce was the important culinary decision. My particular menu choices were just fine-tuning. Keep this concept in mind as you listen through the next several chapters. It's great to look for investments in places others are not, but it's not enough. You also have to look in the right places. If you pre-select investment areas that put you ahead of the game even before you start, the Lutèces of the investment world The most important work is already done. You'll still have plenty of decisions to make, but if you're picking and choosing your spots from an already